This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Navy veteran Charlie Wadhams of Fresno, California, originally from Brockport, New York. We've heard about his duties piloting LCVPs into Pacific beaches and some of the other things he did aboard ship, the USS Brookings, APA 140. We're going to hear about the fascinating job he had during the Korean War in a moment, and I can almost guarantee you're going to hear something you've never heard before. But first, Charlie, you shared a real poignant story about your interactions with young people while you were in Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. Honor Flight, of course, is a nationwide effort to get our World War II veterans to their memorial, which wasn't completed till 2004. It's happening everywhere Hometown Heroes is heard, wherever you're listening today. In fact, if you happen to be listening on California's Central Coast today on affiliate KVEC in San Luis Obispo, you can support Honor Flight Central Coast by going to the Crush and Roll West event August 28th and 29th. I've got that linked at hometownheroesradio.com, and the weather should be great, so go for it. That's just an example, but again, it's happening everywhere. And for you, Charlie, as a World War II veteran, how was that Honor Flight experience?
It was wonderful. There are so many of us who don't have horrendous combat experience, but we're there helping out. And to be thanked for that is really impressive. Everybody's got a story, haven't they?
Amen.
And it's fun to listen to their stories. I got pretty emotional. And several occasions, one at the Iwo Jima Memorial. I wasn't in that battle, really. I came up on it shortly thereafter. But I suppose part of it is because it's beautifully done. But this was the opening experience of this whole thing.
That's the first thing you see. Yeah.
Boy, I'll tell you, they got my attention. Then to go on at World War II and see the bronzes that depicted the battles of my brothers-in-law, Normandy and the Bastogne, and then to be able to honor my good buddy, who's Rick's dad.
You and I know what you're talking about, but the listeners don't. When you said your good buddy, who was Rick's dad, one of your best friends in the Navy had a son who married your daughter.
That's true.
And that's the son-in-law who went with you, Dr. Rick Geller, who went with you on that honor flight. So how did you and his father get to know each other?
What happened was when I got recalled for Korea, the Navy sent me to the postgraduate school at Monterey, and I was trained in cryptography, codes and ciphers and things like that.
Intriguing.
My class was the first one that had gone through this thing. The guys got assigned to LST Division so-and-so, Destroyer Squadron such-and-such, Port Director Wonsan, Korea. They went and did Incheon. I got orders to the staff of the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. It says, whatever port he may be or wherever he is, I'm going there. We understand it's a large concrete building at Pearl Harbor. I reported in there in December of 50.
In between, you had gone to the University of Rochester and graduated there?
Went to school on the GI Bill.
Met your wife?
Met my wife. I was a year ahead of her, and when the war popped, we had a wedding and a three-week honeymoon. I kissed her goodbye and took off. And
wow.
Just like Papa, isn't it?
Yeah, you've got a history, you got a track record here.
Yeah. So when I got to Pearl, I went to work in communications as a top secret watch officer. The guy I was in charge was a lieutenant by the name of Dick Geller. The staff had a thing called a top secret control officer, and then he had four assistants for watch officers. So Dick and I went through a lot of experiences together, and we have our own communications, and then the next piece of this is communications intelligence, all that cryptography and all that kind of stuff at heavy duty. We were mixed up in both sides of it. I really didn't get into code busting until later on. The man who broke the Japanese code was our boss. He was Captain Layton, Eddie Layton.
Mm-hmm.
And he and a man by the name of Rochambeau were the guys who broke the Japanese code, and there's that famous story of Midway and all that kind of stuff. That was Layton, a wonderful man.
So they had broken the Japanese code in World War II, which led to big breakthroughs for America. But as you're there in 1950 and onward, what are the kinds of communications or coded things that you had to deal with?
Security says I can't really tell you a lot about it.
Even now? 65 years later?
Yeah. When you get into communications intelligence, there is not without specific direction. We don't talk. I can tell you a little piece of this, which was, I don't know whether I'll get criticized for this or not. One of the typical jobs that had to be done in code breaking was weather reports. If you ever seen a weather report, it's a series of maybe 20 numbers for barometric pressure, sea state, what the sky looked like, what's the clouds and wind, da-da-da-da, the whole thing, and it's all stated in a series of numbers. The Fleet Weather Central across the street from us needed to have the reports that were put out by the Russian weather stations. They all put in their weather reports every day, and it's going through all of the Eastern Hemisphere. We'd had to get those and break them and give the reports to our weather people so they, if you're in Korea, the weather's going to come from the west, so you got to have those Russian weather reports.
And that was more than just translating language.
It was code busting, yeah.
The weather was transmitted in code. And did you have a key, a legend for that, or you had to figure out what it was?
We had a method for breaking it, yeah.
And you're saying you can't tell us too much about it because some of those methods are still used?
Well, I think a lot of that stuff today is done automatically by computer. I was ultimately called a specialist in communications intelligence. In other words, I was, by definition, a cryptanalyst. And today, they don't have them anymore. My whole specialty is now called network warfare officer. And that just suggests to you it's a whole different ballgame. President Truman came to our headquarters on his way out to fire General MacArthur. So we would handle anything he needed, any messages he needed to send, and there was always work to be done. And so we got to see the president on several occasions.
What did you think of him?
I really liked the man. Politically, I was not on the same track as Harry Truman, but I decided I liked him very much. He was an honest, tough man. He was brought up with one of the big political groups in Missouri. When he became president, he was president of the people, not those political groups in Missouri, which is, got to give him credit for
that. The buck stops here, huh? So six admirals and an ensign. Did Harry Truman treat you any differently than the admirals?
Oh, no. All of those people, when you're talking about that level of command, you're talking about gentlemen. I have to go on and say General MacArthur treated me very well.
What were your interactions with him?
Well, after he fired MacArthur, MacArthur came back and stayed in our guest house, and the University of Hawaii gave him a degree, you know, and he was talking about being president, all this kind of stuff. So we gave the same services to MacArthur as we did Truman. And when Truman went to Wake Island, Wake had no cryptographic resources. The only bachelor in our group was Henry Booth. Hank traveled with the president, and when the president wanted to send us a message, he used a so-called one-time pad. This is a spy device. And he'd send the messages to us, and we'd decipher them and re-encode them in machine systems and send them on. So we all got to work fairly closely with the president, yeah.
That's a pretty unique role that you played there.
Kind of fun.
With the lens of history now, we look back and we know that no one has deployed an atomic weapon in combat since August of 1945. But 5 years later, during the Korean War, there was a lot of talk of that. In fact, General MacArthur said he wanted to drop 20, 30, 50 of them all around Korea and make a wall of nuclear wasteland. And Harry Truman had to make that decision. And at one point, he told the American people that option was on the table. What do you know about all that because of where you were and because of Truman being there, relieving MacArthur and everything that happened there? Is there something that you can clue us into?
Yeah. We started a project which was very highly classified, going back and forth, picking targets.
In North Korea?
Projecting the weather patterns, picking targets, identifying where the weapons were and all that kind of stuff. It went on over a two-week period, and finally when the B-29 was in the air, we got a message that said Operation So-and-So, negative, negative, negative. And then in the end it said, this is a drill. The B-29 was over North Korea, loaded. when they said this is a drill. We never believed it for one cotton picking man.
That it was a drill.
But yeah. What the pressure with Dick Geller and Dick and I, when I was on watch and he was someplace else, if, you know, if I was on the afternoon watch at 4 to 12 or midnight to 8, I'd clue him in on anything that had happened during the time. And the two of us lived very, very closely together. We'd go off in a corner and talk, and our wives would say, "What's going on with you guys?" You know? And of course, we couldn't say a thing to them.
Did they know that you guys were dealing with sensitive stuff? Or were they completely
in
the dark?
Oh, yeah. Yes, they knew.
They knew.
Yeah. But Harry Truman did say no to dropping an atomic bomb on North Korea. I'm inclined to believe that they couldn't find a concentration of Chinese troops that was big enough to make it worth it. For what it would do to the world situation. The Chinese and North Koreans, when they were pushing Marines down, doing something like that would have to be done very, very carefully because you got the front of it, you got the troops mixed.
Collateral damage would have been too significant.
Yeah, collateral damage would, and they were being very careful about collateral damage. I thought President Truman was correct in not doing it at that time.
I want everybody to understand here, because this is pretty significant material that we're dealing with here. The climate is, there's talk of nuclear weapons being used. President Truman's on record saying that that's being considered. There are B-29s that are practicing these runs with dummy bombs that have everything but the fissile material.
No, they had real bombs.
On what you're talking about, but leading up to it. So they've been training, they've been preparing.
Yeah.
But I don't think a lot of people maybe have heard what you're saying right now, that there was actually a B-29 in the air over North Korea, ready on the order to drop a nuclear bomb. And pretty close to point of no return, you get the, what you said, negative, negative, negative. In other words, scrap the mission. Don't drop the bomb.
Well, they sent a flash message, and a flash message is always coming clear. And they say, Operation so-and-so, negative, negative, negative.
In other words, not even bothering with code? Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
So this flash message, it's not encoded anything. It's so urgent, it has to come through in plain English.
Yeah.
So you don't take the chance of them missing the message.
Yeah, I think I remember that it was plain language. I guess I've never heard of a top secret message being sent flash.
So what we're talking about is pretty significant history. History is the things that happened and also the things that didn't happen. And you talk about a world-changing moment, could have been it right there.
Absolutely.
And President Truman, by not dropping that, certainly had a great impact. But what I want to find out is what that meant to you. What was it like to be you in that situation? I'm sure you're carrying this weight of top secret, of responsibility, of everything you're doing, but to know what was happening in that moment and how the world almost changed in that instant, how did you process that?
Yes, it was significant. I was very much aware that my friend Dick was having a tougher time with it than I was. You know, we were really talking about it, I mean, almost hour by hour. He was a wonderful mentor to me. Yeah, I just, all I have to say to you is, it was a heavy load. We knew what we were doing.
Boy, eye-opening, isn't it? Charlie Wadhams, thank you for serving our country in World War II, the Korean War, still in the reserves throughout the Vietnam era, and what a service you've provided with your heartfelt story today. Every once in a while, it's great to grab a little more perspective, and if you followed along, you know Charlie's best friend in the Navy was Dick Geller, whose son married Charlie's daughter. And we're going to hear from that son-in-law, Dr. Rick Geller, briefly before we close. Rick, can you help us understand what this almost 89-year-old means to you?
Well, Charlie's always been there in my life. For my father, Charlie Wadhams was the friend of a lifetime. The friendship that they forged in the Navy lasted as a very strong friendship to the end of my father's life. And when I was very small and Charlie would come to visit my dad, I never saw my dad laugh and smile and enjoy himself the way he did when Charlie was there. I mean, they brought out the best in each other. I've known Charlie literally since the day I was born, and he's just that kind of friendship. And because he was a lot older, that kind of mentoring that he's given me over the years is incredibly precious. When my dad passed away in 1983, Gene and I were engaged to be married, and my dad died suddenly. It was a real blow to us, but Charlie just sort of stepped in, and when I needed the advice of a father, I got it. Sometimes I wasn't on board with thinking that I needed it, but I got it anyway because Charlie loved me. And he loves to fix things and take care of people. But, you know, he's been not just a friend and a father-in-law. Charlie's been a father to me for the last 32 years, and he's just an incredibly special person.
Had your father told you a lot about his own time in the Navy?
No. My father would never speak of his time in the Navy. He told me absolutely nothing about his experience during the Korean conflict. He told me that he was in China during the Second World War, but that's all he ever told me about it. And I asked him why, and he just said, I'd rather not talk about it.
But you've learned quite a bit about your dad through Charlie, I imagine.
Yes.
That you never would have known otherwise.
No, he speaks of my father as a leader and a mentor and a friend. And retrospectively, I can see that in my dad, but Charlie helped me to understand things more fully about my father that were really useful to know. The honor flight itself was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life, not just to share it with Charlie, but to meet so many of the other men and women who had served in World War II. The moment that stands out to me in the flight that Charlie and I took together was we brought three stones from California to leave at the World War II Memorial, one each for Charlie's two brother-in-laws who had been in the Army in the European theater. And then we left a stone in the Pacific theater for my father. And then the two of us, two grown men, fell into each other's arms and just sobbed, remembering my dad and what he meant to us. And in that same moment, what we meant to each other.
Well, I know what both of you have shared today means a whole lot to everybody listening. Find a photo of Charlie Wadhams and his son-in-law, Rick Geller, together on their honor flight at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I wish we could go on, but we're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time for another opportunity to be reminded through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.